you have the real broadcast. Yours is the one that really counts and has entertained and educated people for 1967, I guess. Huh?
Yeah, it's been with a brief interruption when CBS, in an ill-advised move, made me the anchorman of the morning news on television. Except for that, I've been out there wandering in that old bus for 18 years.
Well, you say in your introduction to On the Road that you're not a real reporter anymore. Now, why don't you clarify that remark? Because I don't believe it.
Well, real reporters cover wars and politics and calamities and dodge bullets and interview politicians. And I never do any of those things any longer. From the time when CBS let me start wandering down the back roads doing stories without any relevance or significance or importance to them, I found that I liked it. I found a home out there on the back roads and in the small towns.
Almost like it was when you were growing up in North Carolina, huh?
Well, really, I suppose that does have something to do with it. I do have a little bit of a rural background, and somehow feel at home out there in the countryside. The other nice thing about it, of course, is that I don't have any competition. I never have to try to find a place for my camera in the bank of 18 others that are getting ready to cover the news conference. So there isn't any competitiveness to On the Road. Nobody else is interested in an Ohio butcher who can hold more eggs in his hand than anybody else. You know, it's nice to have stories all to yourself.
In fact, there is such a sameness about journalism. And I've been a street reporter for a long time, and television and radio, and still work with hard news during the day. And it seems to me that one fire is almost like every other fire, and one political announcement is almost like every other political announcement. And on and on and on, and it becomes to the point where you can write a story and almost leave blanks and fill in names and dates and streets and this sort of thing, or cities. But you can't do it the way you cover stories, and I think that when you say you're not a reporter anymore, you are indeed a reporter because you look for people to talk to, and that's, to me, what journalism is all about, finding people and trying to tell the story of their lives. You've done that well, and I wanted you to just give me some samples of the type of people you talk about. For example, you've broken down On the Road into a number of sections. For example, you open it up, I believe, with a section called Unlikely Heroes. Now, I don't want you to go into any detail because the book speaks for itself, and certainly your reports on the air speak for themselves. But just the type of person. Just give me a couple of examples of some unlikely heroes.
Oh, I met a doctor in Lincoln, Missouri, Doc Knuckles, who's been practicing there, I guess, for 50 years, and who never has charged anybody anything. Oh, if they can afford to pay, he might charge a dollar or two. He charges for the medicine he dispenses, just what it cost him. He gets paid in buttermilk and turnip greens and homemade apple pies. It just has always seemed wrong to him to charge people who can't afford to pay, as he very well knows. I think of... we met a woman in Buffalo, South Carolina, named Agatha Burgess, who's sort of like Doc Knuckles. She cooks instead. She cooks lunch every day and serves it to anybody who wants to come and eat. She does charge about what it costs her, but there are a number of people in town who can't afford to pay, and she doesn't charge anything. These are perfectly remarkable people, of course. I'm not sure it's the way I'd want to live my life, but I've come upon so many of them that I've begun to think that there is a spirit of generosity in the country, of a... they are heroes. You could call them heroes, I suppose. They're people who, without any religious or evident deep moral reason, just decided they'd like to do good for others and spend their lives that way.
How about an example of a different drummer?
Well, there are many different drummers in America. I think we listened when Thoreau said we should march to the drummer that we hear. We met all kinds of backwoods guides and people who've done remarkable things in their lives. I think of Mrs. White, Edna Gardner White, lives there in Roanoke, Texas. She was an early flyer. She learned to fly long before Amelia Earhart did. What's remarkable about her is that at the age of 82, she's still teaching flying. She has about 27 students come in each week, and she especially loves to teach young women to fly because she remembers the difficulty which she had as a young woman trying to get some man to teach her. I think we do march to the drummer that we hear. A lot of Americans do. Another sort of pioneer I remember interviewing was the first woman ever to drive a car across the country. It's easy for a woman to drive a car across the country today, but in 1919 you had to open gates and drive down a lot of muddy roads. So we found her and did a story about her. The spirit of individualism is really alive in the country. If I've become persuaded of anything in all these years, it's that.
Charles Geraldt, you have gone to the people who live in small-town America, and I picture myself being one very isolated, living here east of the Hudson River in New York for almost 20 years, and I wonder about small-town America. America seems so well-connected now with cable television and interstates and computers. It's really hard to think of small-town America, but as we read on the road and as we see your reports on television, it seems that there is a small-town America that still survives.
The interstate highway makes it possible to drive from coast to coast without seeing anything or feeling anything, having any experiences. But if you get off the interstate highway, you find an America with great differences between the regions, a rich and varied country that's still there. I just like listening to people talk in all the varied accents of the country, just to name one difference. You can tell a Vermonter from an Alabaman within 5 seconds of hearing the fellow start talking, can't you? You still can, in spite of the fact that they both have cable television. They don't talk like television announcers, at least not yet. Maybe we are becoming homogenized as a country. McDonald's hamburgers do taste the same in Maine as they taste in Oregon. But I believe that those regional differences in outlook as well as in accent, differences in attitude about things, do exist. And somehow, I know it makes my job more interesting. I think it makes the country richer, too.
You still use the motor home?
Yes, we wander around in a battered old bus, three of us, looking for stories to send back to Dan Rather.
What happens when you breeze into or rattle into a small town in this
rattle is the word.
In this bus, and you talk to some obscure person who does something unique and isn't there a certain celebrity that you bring by being on national television, and you become the focus of your trips into these towns?
I try very hard to avoid that. Sometimes it happens a little. The Country Weekly will come and interview us for our coming to town as a story to them. Even though very often we're coming, by the way, to do a story in the town that the Country Weekly's never done, for the very good reason that everybody in town already knows about it. It's not news to them. But I try not to come on like a big-time television correspondent, and the camera crew I work with is not self-important either. And we know that we don't want to scare people. I suppose when 60 Minutes goes out to do a story, they go with two camera crews and producers and researchers and Mike Wallace.
Only, not always. Sometimes they hide the cameras.
That's right. But anyway, normally with banners flying. And if that kind of crowd rolled up into the yard of a farmer in Indiana, he'd be terrified. So we do go to some lengths to avoid making ourselves the story in any way. I often leave myself out of the stories. I'm just the off-camera voice asking questions. Which I think is the way it ought to be. I think there is a little too much ego in television news. And while
no.
You've noticed, have you?
Are you your own producer and writer?
Yes. There's no one to produce or write but me. But the stories sort of produce themselves, you know. They don't need a producer. We show up and shoot the breeze with somebody and take a few pictures. And after a while, when I can imagine it in my head that making a story out of all this, then we stop and go to the next place. And the hard part for me is sitting down that night in the motel room writing the story. The writing comes hard for me because you have to be so economical in television. You only get 2 or 3 or 4 minutes to tell a story that you have to choose your words carefully.
Well, there's something that a lot of people overlook because you are a broadcast a journalist, and that is the quality of the writing. Sometimes because of the visual nature of broadcasting, the words are forgotten. Or maybe they're not forgotten, but maybe in some way they sink in and people remember vividly the reports. It's certainly the case with you. But here, for the first time, people will have a chance to actually see what you have written in terms of words and the way you express things to people. Because you talk the way people talk. This is a wonderful chance to see some excellent writing. The writing in many of these pieces is marvelous writing. And so it's wonderful that it can be preserved in the form of a book, because it has some permanency that somehow broadcasters lose by simply the nature of the medium.
Boy, that's the truth, isn't it? Your best work goes flying through the ether, never to come back again. It travels at the speed of light, and it's gone forever. I was talking to a newspaper reporter just today and said to her, well, at least you can clip your pieces out and keep them in a cigar box, you know. Our pieces are, by and large, never going to be seen again. And it pleases me to have made a book out of the stories. It's something you can pick up and heft and thumb through and show your grandchildren what you did for a living. I am one of those who thinks that writing counts, even in a picture medium. It was E.B. White, wasn't it, who said good writing elevates people and bad writing depresses people. And I think that's especially true when the writing is amplified and put on the air and reaches the ears of millions of people.
Mm. The pictures you have in the book On the Road, these came right from the videotapes.
Yes. So
is it a videotape that you use or film?
It's videotape now. Mm-hmm. We did film for most of the years of On the Road, but we were about to get left behind by technology, so kicking and screaming, we moved over to videotape. We've grown to like it. I like it because I can sit down right away and see how bad that interview was without having to wait a day.
Terrific. Yes. The viewers of CBS News have a lot to do with the story selection, don't they? The direction you go on the road to find the people that you talk to.
Well, I rely on letters from viewers for story ideas. You develop a sort of sixth sense about which story ideas will work out, and I save those letters, treasure them, and often end up doing the story, sometimes years after I got the letter, because if we get a letter from Utah while we're working in Vermont, sometimes it takes a while to get there. But I suppose about half the stories are ones that we just come upon. We'll see a sign on a high school gym that says wrestling tonight, and stop and see who's wrestling, and that's how we end up spending a week doing a story about Wahoo McDaniel, a wrestler. Or we'll see kids swinging in a tree, and if we have our wits about us, decide, well, it's such a pretty sight, let's see if we can't do a story about kids swinging from a rope tied to a tree limb.
How often do you take the rope?
Well, every week, pretty nearly. I do a program in New York on Sunday, a television program, Sunday morning, and right after that, normally I fly out and meet the crew wherever I left them, and we set out down the road.
So the bus is on the road most of the time, and you shuttle back and forth.
I must nowadays, now that I do that Sunday program. Mm-hmm. But There's a sort of romance in it, of plugging in the coffee pot in the morning and heading down the road. Lots of travelers have felt that. I've read it in the books of travelers, of which I have a considerable collection. And I understand it myself now, that sense of adventure that comes from not quite knowing in the morning how the day will end.
Well, not only do you write about small-town America and small-town people, but one of the most moving broadcasts you did, I didn't see the broadcast, but I certainly had the chance to read it, and that was the one in which a great-grandfather by the name of Kuralt landed apparently in, I don't know if Ellis Island was Ellis Island, but it was in the lower part of Manhattan, and started a new generation of Kuralts in the United States, and that was a very touching story.
In 76, as our little contribution to the bicentennial, we went around to every state and did a little moment of history from each of them, something that characterized the state, if I could think of something. And when we got to New York, I could think of nothing more characteristic than the great story of immigration of all those, including my great-grandfather and maybe yours. Actually, most the great-great-great-grandfathers of most of us stepped ashore in Manhattan. This was the great portal to the world for so many years. And, yeah, I liked doing that story myself. I don't like making personal references very much, but I happened to find out that my great-great-grandfather did step ashore at Castle Garden, which was the immigration point of the day, and couldn't resist putting myself into his footsteps as you walked through that dark tunnel and emerged into the light of Manhattan and the light of America.
I have a feeling my relatives were sent to North Carolina on prison boats, and that's
some
which
of mine.
We sprang.
Some of mine were too.
Well, it's a wonderful chance to read your work and not just to see it, but to actually sit down and read it and mull over it and study it. And so it's a treat for me, being a fan of yours for so many years. And I want to thank you for coming in and chatting with me. And I'll look forward to getting this on the air. It won't have the impact as on the road does on Dan Rather, but but it will be heartfelt.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.